This podcast is made by and for internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while vetted by residents, is not personally verified by our hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts in these topics. The content provided in this podcast and in any linked materials is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We try to stay away from opinions, but all opinions represented are our own and not of the University of Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome
to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to the other side of the street. I'm over here with Billy Sullivan to talk about some of the morning reports over here. So to start things off, Billy, I think we have a couple of morning reports that are conveniently related. The first one I heard was talking about neurologic dysfunction as a predictor of hospital outcomes. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That's right, Eddie. JJ actually presented a case in Morning Report of an older woman presenting with what we thought initially was sepsis, turns out may have been a allopurinol-induced drug allergy. And, you know, there were all these sort of interesting things that certainly went on in the case, but he chose to focus on how altered mental status, particularly delirium, is actually a really poor predictor of in-hospital and long-term outcomes in patients, something that we see a lot of, something that we know Vanderbilt does a lot of work in, but I don't think something that we think about explicitly, say, for example, when we're rounding on patients outside of the ICU. And the first thing that JJ did was he started with something that we've all become familiar with, which is the QSOFA score, and discussed, you know, the three different components of that score: the respiratory rate, systolic blood pressure, and altered mental status, in particular the Glasgow Coma Scale. And when you look at in-hospital mortality associated with a positive score on either of these three metrics, so respiratory rate greater than 22, systolic blood pressure less than 100, or a GCS of 13 or less, it's actually the Glasgow Coma Scale and altered mental status that has the highest odds ratio for in-hospital mortality.
Billy, a GCS of 13 doesn't seem that hard to get.
Yeah, that's right. If you look at the three aspects of the Glasgow Coma Scale, we have the eye-opening response, verbal response, and then a motor response. And you've only got to lose 2 points to get to a GCS of 13. And that could be as simple as losing a point for not being able to obey commands. And then if you're not oriented, those two things, it can get you a GCS of 13. Also, if you're unable to localize to a painful stimulus, or you don't have appropriate words or make an appropriate statement in response to a question, those can also lose you 2 points just off the bat. So you're right, Eddie, it's not really hard, and you don't have to be terribly altered to get yourself a GCS score of 13 or less. So while not directly related to delirium as we understand it, I think it was important that JJ led off with this idea that brain dysfunction or acute brain injury in some way, shape, or form tends to be a much more significant predictor of adverse outcomes than, say, the things we tend to focus on, like vital signs. If we look more specifically at delirium, or, you know, the onset of delirium in the hospital, just having delirium as part of your presentation, and again, this could be either hyperactive delirium. These are the patients who are actively confused, trying to get out of bed, maybe having hallucinations, maybe being disrespectful or giving pushback to nursing staff. Those are patients that are easy to identify. It includes not only those patients, but also includes those with hypoactive delirium. These are the silent patients who are confused, but we may not know about it until we ask them. And if you have any patient with delirium, their risk of mortality is much higher. Their risk of being institutionalized for a long period of time after their hospitalization is much higher. And maybe not shockingly, but I think the numbers are quite shocking, is that they have almost an 11-fold increased risk of subsequent dementia after their hospitalization as compared to their matched counterparts who did not experience delirium in the hospital. And not only does the experience of delirium decrease in-hospital survival or survival to hospital discharge, it also really increases mortality over a number of years. In one of the meta-analyses that JJ talked about, there's a really nice Kaplan-Meier curve to show that there's a tremendous number of people that will die within the first 2 years after experiencing an episode of delirium while being acutely hospitalized. And so while we focus on a lot of things in the hospital with regard to organ dysfunction, so for example, you know, elevated BUN or creatinine, tachypnea, altered mental status, altered mentation, delirium is actually probably a better predictor of any adverse outcome than even, say, for example, an elevated lactate or lactic acidosis. And so what I want you all to remember is that delirium is a signal of brain dysfunction, acute brain injury, and just like we think about, you know, acute kidney injury, acute myocardial infarction. The brain is important. The body preferentially will take care of the brain. And so if there's acute brain injury, you know that the underlying illness is significant. And you also know that your patient is at higher risk for mortality and other adverse outcomes.
So Billy, I think you've convinced me that this is pretty important, but is there anything that we can do for these patients?
So actually, since this morning report was given, one of the MIND USA studies was published in the New England Journal, and this, of course, is our pulmonary critical care group here at Vanderbilt. And just to give you guys sort of a brief highlight of what this study showed is it took about 1,100 patients who developed delirium while they were in the ICU. That delirium was diagnosed with a standardized and validated measurement, which we're all used to using, the CAM ICU. And patients were randomized to receiving either haloperidol, which is a typical antipsychotic, ziprasidone, an atypical antipsychotic, or placebo, and measured the number of days that the patients were alive without dementia or coma. So basically, were they able to shorten the duration of delirium by providing an atypical or typical antipsychotic? And the short answer and the sort of bottom line is no, that pharmacologic treatment of acute delirium for patients in the ICU setting has not been shown in this pretty large population to decrease the duration of delirium. And while it's important for us to know that there really aren't any pharmacologic agents to use, there are things that we can do. And, you know, the things that have been shown to help are reorientation strategies, sort of day-night cycles, things that may not feel like we're doing a lot, but things that you can actually engage family members, engage nursing staff, and to really feel like they're supported a patient and to helping keep them as calm and as oriented as possible. Now, this isn't to say that you can't use atypical or typical antipsychotics if a patient has hyperactive delirium and is at risk of harming themselves or someone else. That's certainly a different indication with a different targeted outcome. You're not really trying to reduce the duration of delirium, but rather increase patient safety in that situation.
So, Billy, we talked a lot about delirium and acute neurologic dysfunction, but sometimes we use atypical antipsychotics to control behavior for our patients who have dementia. Is there any data behind that?
Yeah, Eddie. So another MedPeds resident actually gave a morning report on this. And Tara presented a patient who she noticed was on an atypical antipsychotic and had dementia and wanted to, you know, answer this question. Is this going to be helpful for this patient? And you know, the first thing she led off with is that there's actually a black box warning for atypical antipsychotics and increased mortality in elderly patients who have dementia-related psychosis. And despite that, this is probably still a very common practice, not only for us, but certainly in the community. And if you look at patients with dementia who are on varied array of psychotropic medications, so for example, SSRIs, atypical antipsychotics, combined SSRI with an atypical antipsychotic, and you look at their survival curves over the course of about a year, there was a study from 2007 that showed that patients who were either on no medication or were on some generally standard medication like an SSRI, their Kaplan-Meier curves demonstrated increased survival compared with those who were on a conventional antipsychotic or an atypical antipsychotic. And, you know, this is some of the data that led to the development of this black box warning. And so if you dial down to some of the more common medications that we use both in and outside of the hospital for patients with dementia who have behavioral disturbances, we use things like olanzapine, quetiapine, risperidone, and sometimes acutely Haldol. One of the things that Tara wanted to highlight was that it's not sort of a neutral, if you use it, it won't help. There's actually some data that suggests if you use it, you may harm. And she presented a paper from JAMA Psychiatry just 3 years ago that calculated the number needed to harm for a lot of these common medications. And if you adjust for risk differences across a patient population that suffers from dementia, and you calculate a number needed to harm for these medications, the numbers are actually surprisingly low. So for example, Haldol, the number needed to harm is actually 8 patients with a range of 6 to 12. And some of the common ones that we like to use in the hospital, so for example, olanzapine, the number needed to harm is only 14. And for quetiapine, it's actually only 31. So still pretty low for a patient population that we often prescribe these medications to. So if you look at studies that have tried to determine the benefit of these medications, a lot of them have looked at sort of two main outcome measures. One is the measure of psychosis symptoms, and the other is measures of agitation. And For the most part, there's really no benefit to these medications. For psychosis, risperidone or Risperdal barely favored treatment by a small margin in terms of improving psychosis symptoms. And for agitation, risperidone and aripiprazole, as well as olanzapine, did show some improvement on agitation scores. So given that there are relatively low numbers needed to harm for these medications, you know, you need to try and do a risk-benefit calculus for yourself, for a patient, for the family, and figure out if there is a benefit. Does that benefit outweigh the harm? And if you look at the effect of these antipsychotics on two of the main symptoms that we try to control, one being psychosis and the second being agitation, risperidone, Abilify, and olanzapine do show a statistically significant improvement in agitation. Quetiapine doesn't show a difference. For psychosis, only risperidone shows a difference. So here we are with risperidone showing improvements in agitation and psychosis, olanzapine also showing improvements in agitation. Going back to the number needed to harm, risperidone, 16, olanzapine, 14. And so you're faced with this question. You know, we know that there's an increased risk of mortality with this class of medications. It seems to be that quetiapine poses the least risk. However, quetiapine shows the least efficacy in terms of which of these medications might be the most helpful. Risperidone and olanzapine are the most helpful, but they may have the most harm. And so you've got to present this to families. You should think about this with your team. And so this is a challenging situation. It's not easy to treat patients who have dementia. They require a lot of support. Their families require a lot of support. We want to help families be able to take care of them. And sometimes that means trying as best we can to reduce some of their acting out behaviors. But it really needs to be a conversation. You really need to be thoughtful about whether or not it's worth prescribing these medications for patients with dementia.
So Billy, one of my favorite conferences over here is the CRC, and I heard recently we had a couple of interesting ones. Can you fill me in on that?
Yeah, I wanted to give a couple of quick pearls from some of the recent CRCs over here. So Alice presented a great case of a man who had emigrated from Saudi Arabia, but was a college student here in Nashville, presented with these intermittent fevers for a number of weeks, and ultimately after an incredibly thorough workup that I think she described had about seven different consulting teams involved, was diagnosed with Q fever. And this is not something we hear about a whole lot, which makes it a perfect case for a CRC, but wanted to sort of bring it to your attention and see if you could keep it on your differential. So Q fever is a zoonotic disease. It's primarily found in sort of farm animals. And, you know, the classic sort of board question is that a patient was helping deliver a goat baby or, you know, was around a cow that was giving birth. And the reason that's one of the more common presentations, at least on a standardized question, is that this disease does like placental tissue. But you don't have to be involved with the birth of an animal. Just contact with a farm animal that is a potential vector of the disease can certainly put you at risk. And the organism itself is Coxiella. And Coxiella is an intracellular gram-negative organism. It's actually something that you should think about in terms of the way it functions, like we think about Legionella as an intracellular organism. And the way that humans come in contact with this is actually via a couple different ways. The first is inhalation. You can inhale these organisms when in close proximity to an infected animal. You can actually inoculate yourself via direct contact. And you could also potentially ingest the organism drinking infected milk. There are kind of two main presentations for Q fever. The first is acute Q fever. Usually the incubation period is about 2 to 3 weeks, so it's a little bit longer than we usually typically think of. Most patients are actually asymptomatic when they first acquire the illness. If they do have symptoms, the two most common symptoms that patients are going to have are going to have flu-like symptoms. So these myalgias, fevers, chills, sort of nonspecific, potentially seeming like viral symptoms. And then the other is pulmonary symptoms. So a lot of times this will cause an acute pneumonia. So patients will present with cough, maybe increased work of breathing. When they present, they have elevated inflammatory markers, as you might expect, really minimal leukocytosis. And one of the, I wouldn't say hallmarks, but one of the more common things that you will see here is elevated transaminases. And so, you know, while we have certain infections like Legionella, for example, that we think of with maybe some hyponatremia, maybe some elevated transaminases, Coxiella too can cause elevated transaminases. The other type of presentation is a more chronic presentation. It can be much more indolent, and it tends to like vascular and articular spaces. And so, you know, one of the things that the faculty were talking about during this CRC was the fact that Q fever can cause a culture negative endocarditis that can cause relapsing fevers over quite a long period of time. It can also cause vascular infections. So for example, a dialysis fistula, and then can cause articular infections and present as sort of a more indolent septic arthritis. Treatment of acute is relatively straightforward. We use doxycycline, treat for 2 weeks. There's not a whole lot of data on the treatment of chronic Q fever. And Alice was telling us that in general, patients are treated with doxycycline on the order of months, sometimes even greater than 1 year. Again, these are for these endovascular infections that are difficult to detect and difficult to treat.
And you know, Billy, I'm very partial to pulmonary, so I was very excited to hear about Blake's.
Yeah, Blake gave a great sort of cryptic, I wouldn't say misleading, but CRC that had a number of red herrings involved that made for a really awesome differential diagnosis. She presented a 48-year-old gentleman with some mild hypertension, hyperlipidemia, who presented with really the acute onset of hypoxemic respiratory failure, requiring the pretty rapid escalation of BiPAP after presentation. And the cool thing about this is it was a pretty classic or typical presentation of a pretty rare illness. And the patient ended up having acute eosinophilic pneumonia. But of course, you know, common things being common, when we think about patients who are having trouble breathing, cough, maybe productive of sputum and some fevers, we think about infectious causes. And there was a tremendously extensive workup for this patient, fungal studies, et cetera. But the diagnostic test that really cinched it was early on in his course, he had bronchoscopy, and a BAL showed an eosinophil count of about 48%. And so I just wanted to let you guys know a little bit about acute eosinophilic pneumonia, something you should keep on your differential for patients who have rapidly progressive respiratory failure, particularly patients who were otherwise healthy and not necessarily either immunocompromised or frail in any way. In order to diagnose acute eosinophilic pneumonia, you obviously have to have a respiratory failure. There usually is an antecedent acute febrile illness. And the typical presentation, as we talked about in conferences, there's this diffuse bilateral infiltrate that can sometimes look like reverse pulmonary edema. The BAL is what's diagnostic, and you have to have more than 25% eosinophils on the BAL. And Blake did spend some time talking about the differential of lung disease associated with BAL eosinophilia. I'm not going to go through all these, but I do want to let you know that the percentage of eosinophils in the BAL does provide a significant diagnostic clue. And so you can look up your differential if the eosinophil count is less than 25% or greater than 25%. And it can really sway you in terms of what could be causing the pulmonary eosinophilia. Two of the main things that I want you all to take away from what Blake talked about is, number one, the treatment is steroids. For those of us who have seen a case of this, it's actually incredibly remarkable how quickly these patients get better on high-dose steroids. If you're thinking about treating them, be prepared for a pretty rapid response and a rapid resolution of their hypoxemia and respiratory failure. And the last thing is that it seems to be that there's an association with cigarette smoking. While we don't know specifically what causes acute eosinophilic pneumonia, one of the observations that's been made when sort of reflecting on the recent history of some of these patients is that a number of them have either recently taken up smoking or have recently increased the amount that they were smoking. And so if people continue to smoke, it's quite possible that they could have a recurrence of the disease. But it has been observed that if patients quit smoking, it's very, very unlikely for them to have a recurrence of acute eosinophilic pneumonia.
All right, guys, thanks for listening and learning with me. As always, I appreciate any feedback, but until next time.